programming at Perimeter Institute. I'm delighted to see all of you. Welcome to another lecture as part of Einstein Fest, and delighted to welcome John Dawson to the Institute today. John Dawson is professor of mathematics at Pennsylvania State University. Born in Wichita, Kansas, he was a National Merit Scholar at MIT and received his PhD in mathematical logic from the University of Michigan. Following early work in axiomatic set theory, since 1979, his research has focused on the life and work of Kurt Gödel. During the years 1982 to 84, he cataloged Gödel's papers at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And from 1982 to 2003, he served as co-editor of the five volumes of Gödel's collected works. His full-length biography, Logical Dilemmas, The Life and Work of Kurt Gödel, was published by A.K. Peters in 1997 and was reissued in paperback in 2005. Professor Dawson has served as editor-in-chief of the Journal of History and Philosophy of Logic since 2001. He's a member of the American Mathematical Society, the Association for Symbolic Logic, the History of Science Society, and the Canadian Society for History and Philosophy of Mathematics. We're delighted to have him with us. Please welcome John Dawson.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm very honored to be invited to address this audience today as part of this marvelous event, the Einstein Fest, celebrating the centennial of Einstein's Annus Mirabilis in 1905. It's also of interest that it turns out that next year is the centennial of Kurt Gödel's birth, so my talk will bridge two centennials. And this building also bears a rather strong resemblance to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where Einstein and Gödel were colleagues for 15 years, from 1940 to 1955. I know that this building was, in fact, the result of some research that involved travel to various institutes of research, one of which was the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And I'll be talking more about that institution and its character as we move further into the talk. So the subject of my talk is the friendship and the collegial relationship between two of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century, Albert Einstein in physics, Kurt Gödel in mathematical logic. Einstein, of course, is well known to all of you, a very famous public figure. Kurt Gödel is very likely much less well known to you, in part because of his reclusive personality, but also because mathematics, and especially mathematical logic, is simply a less visible subject than physics. So let us look at the two individuals, with Gödel on the left and Einstein on the right. This photograph is a candid photograph that was taken in the early 50s by Richard Ahrens, who was a mathematician that was visiting the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, much as the temporary members here visit the Perimeter Institute. It's an interesting photo because it shows the contrast between the two men. Einstein, in his typically disheveled dress, makes Gödel look pretty good. Gödel looks nattily dressed. It's a pleasant photograph, pleasant expression on both of their faces. I don't think you'll ever see a photograph of Gödel without those same glasses. He seems to have worn them throughout his entire life. So you can tell the age difference here. Gödel born in 1906 and Einstein born in 1879. So this photograph is taken less than 10 years before Einstein's death, but rather in the middle of Gödel's career at the Institute. Now, I'd like to look at what happens if we block out Einstein so that you can see that this seemingly nattily dressed person is actually wearing a very ill-fitting suit. He's really no more concerned about his appearance than Einstein was. It's an unusual photograph of Gödel in that he is not bundled up heavily in a coat and a muffler, He's a very, very thin individual. He ate very little, and so he was perpetually cold, even in the hot summertime in Princeton. So in that sense, the photograph is not very typical. Well, I won't dwell a lot on Einstein's career, because I think you already know a great deal about it through the exhibits here and the other talks. But he began his academic career as a student at the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. And although born in Ulm, became a Swiss citizen shortly after he entered the ETH, and conveniently enough was declared unfit for military service in the Swiss Army. He had some difficulty obtaining an academic position, and so took a job as a patent examiner, which turned out to be very fruitful, because it gave him not only the chance to examine a lot of ideas that other people had and to critically judge their worth, but also gave him a sufficient free time to develop his own ideas. And so he burst upon the scene in 1905 in the so-called miracle year, the year that he, on the one hand, obtained his doctorate, and on the other hand, published six fundamental papers, including two on special relativity, one containing the famous equation E equals MC squared. There was also a paper on the photoelectric effect, for which he later won the Nobel Prize, and a paper on molecular dimensions, which helped to establish the reality of the concept of molecules. 3 years later, he became a Privatdozent at Bern. Privatdozent means a private lecturer, private in the sense that he was not paid by the state. Indeed, Privatdozenten were not paid at all by any organization. They had the right to charge for their lectures, but they couldn't charge very much, or they wouldn't have very many students. So it was not a position that one could live at very long unless you had other means of doing so. But it was the traditional stepping stone to an academic career, and it remains so today. It's also true that you cannot become a Privatdozent just on the basis of a doctoral dissertation. You have to submit a second paper known as a Habilitationsschrift. And in fact, when Einstein first applied for a docenter, he was denied because he had not yet published that second paper. We can compare this with Kurt Gödel in his early career. He was born in Brno, Moravia, the largest city in Moravia, which at that time was part of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. He was born on 28th April 1906 and was schooled there in Brno, a town not particularly eminent, although it was also the site of Gregor Mendel's experiments in genetics in the previous century. He graduated from the gymnasium there in Brno in 1924 and entered the University of Vienna, about 50 miles distant. Vienna was at that time one of the most prestigious universities in Europe. And Gödel's older brother had gone there 4 years earlier to study medicine and later became a radiologist in Vienna. Like Einstein, Gödel changed his citizenship shortly after he became established in Vienna. And he too proved a very important result in his dissertation. I'll talk more about that in a moment. He proved that what is called first-order logic, a system of logical axioms and rules of inference that had been developed late in the 19th century, was adequate for its purpose. It did all that it ought to, and the technical term for that is to say that it's semantically complete. Then in September 1930, he attended a conference in Königsberg, East Prussia, ostensibly to talk about his doctoral dissertation, the so-called completeness theorem. And he did speak for 20 minutes, a typical short talk by a person that was new upon the scene. But he also attended a discussion session later in the conference, just one day later, actually, Following some lectures about the major philosophies of mathematics that had been developed up to that time. There were three competing philosophies of mathematics, known as logicism, formalism, and intuitionism. And there was a discussion session after these addresses, and there was a feeling that a feeling of great optimism that any mathematical problem that the human mind could conceive could be solved by mathematical methods. And Gödel's completeness results seem just another encouraging sign of that. But in fact, at that discussion session, Gödel got up and in a very quiet way announced that, by the way, there happened to be some statements that are neither provable nor disprovable in number theory. And so there's some facts about the ordinary whole numbers that you're not going to be able to prove, even though they're true. And that was an absolutely shocking fact that very few people in attendance really appreciated at the time. 3 years later, he too became a privat docent. He was able to survive in that position for a time because his family was relatively wealthy. But on the other hand, the economic crisis that had hit the world, of course, in 1929 had begun to have its effects. And, of course, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had collapsed after World War I. So although Vienna was a very exciting place to be intellectually in the period between the wars, the Viennese Empire had collapsed, and so economically it was a time of great stringency. Let me say just a bit more about the completeness theorem. If you set up axioms for doing geometry or number theory or whatever mathematical subject you're interested in, you hope that you will have gotten enough basic principles as axioms that you will be able to prove everything that's true on the basis of those axioms. And that's exactly what Gödel proved to be the case, that the logical framework that had been developed up to that time was strong enough so that the statements that you could prove coincide with those that are true in all interpretations that satisfy the axioms. So this was indeed a very encouraging result and showed that the work of earlier logicians had been correct and did not need to be extended by the addition of extra axioms. However, axiom systems are intended to describe specific structures of mathematical interest, such as the integers or Euclidean space. The completeness theorem does not say that all statements that are true in a specific structure, such as the whole numbers, are provable from the axioms. It only says that those statements are provable which are true in all interpretations that satisfy the axioms. And if there happen to be other structures, unintended structures, that also satisfy those axioms, then only those statements will be provable that are true in all of those structures, not the statements that are true in a specific one of those structures. We know, for example, in the history of geometry, that for a long time it was assumed that only Euclidean geometry made sense, and it took a long time for non-Euclidean geometries to be recognized as consistent systems. Still, it was hoped that arithmetic, at least, was not subject to that kind of problem. So in particular, in the so-called incompleteness theorem of 1931, Gödel showed that no matter how you set up your axioms for arithmetic, if your axiom system is at all reasonable, in particular if you can recognize an axiom when you see one, and if those axioms are consistent, then they admit interpretations in which some statements that are true of the ordinary whole numbers, positive whole numbers, are false. And those statements are neither provable nor refutable from the axioms. He gave an example of a specific statement such that neither it nor its negation are provable. But obviously one of those two statements has to be true. So he gave an example of a statement that is true but unprovable. And it's basically a mathematical translation, if you will, or an encoding of the statement, this mathematical statement is not provable. It is true, and since it affirms that it's not provable, it isn't. It's a variation on the old a liar paradox, but it is not a paradox. The liar paradox, which is the statement, this sentence is false, it can be neither true nor false, but Gödel's mathematical statement refers to provability rather than truth, and is not a self-contradictory statement. If we compare the impact of the results of Einstein and Gödel, Einstein's theory of special relativity had to do with the nature of time and showed that Newtonian mechanics, the basis of physics up to that point, had to be modified for velocities approaching the speed of light. Showed that time would run slower and measuring rods would shrink at velocities close to that of light. Gödel's incompleteness theorem, on the other hand, upset what is usually called the Euclidean paradigm. The idea, which actually predates Euclid, that the way to do mathematics is to set up axioms and use precise logical rules of inference to derive consequences from them. Gödel's incompleteness theorem shows that if you started with a fixed set of axioms, that that's inadequate for deriving all true statements of arithmetic. Now, you can look at this either as a devastating result or as an encouraging one, saying that there's always going to be more to discover, there will always be axioms that need to be added, and mathematicians will never be put out of business. The two were definitely contrasting personalities. Einstein was gregarious, at least in public, genial, citizen of the world that was, his face was well known to everyone, even children, instantly recognized. And in fact, one of his problems was obtaining some privacy because he was so well known. And he became politically active, especially in the causes of Zionism and of peace. Gödel, on the other hand, was very reclusive. He was a hypochondriac and unfortunately also developed paranoia relatively early in his life. He shunned public controversy, made very few public statements, and as a result was virtually unknown outside the mathematical community. He seemed to be very otherworldly. In public, he was extremely apolitical, which served him well during the Nazi occupation of Austria in the late 30s, because when it became his turn to be scrutinized by the Nazis, they couldn't find that he'd ever uttered a single word either in favor of or against National Socialism. Which, from their point of view, was suspicious. if you weren't for them, you must be against them. If you read a number of accounts, including accounts by people that should have known better, such as Bertrand Russell, you will see the claim that Gödel was Jewish, but he was not. In fact, he was not a member of any ordinary organized religious sect, although his family was nominally Lutheran. So he was not forced to leave Europe because of his ethnicity, but as we'll see, he did have a difficult time getting out nonetheless. Despite their contrasting personalities, they did have certain things in common. Neither of them, for example, believed in chance. Einstein is famous for having said, God doesn't play dice. And Gödel, in one of his notes, said that every chaos is merely a wrong appearance, evidence that we simply haven't understood things properly, and that if we knew more about it, it wouldn't appear to be random, but we would understand the causes behind it. In addition, both, to some extent, were left behind by their fields and were unwilling to accept some of the consequences of their own discoveries. Einstein, of course, struggled for many years to try to develop a unified field theory. And although Einstein was one of the first to obtain results in what became quantum theory, and though he accepted certain versions of quantum theory, he didn't accept the relativistic version of quantum theory. And that was primarily because of its conflict with causality. Gödel, on the other hand, was a believer that the human mind is capable of settling every mathematical question, in spite of the incompleteness theorems, which many people felt gave evidence the other direction. And in his later work, Gödel moved away from results in mathematical logic, and after he came to Princeton, worked primarily in philosophy, although he did not publish anything much in that area, and also in physics, and in fact did some significant work in relativity theory, which has remained relatively little known, especially among mathematicians. There are also some other parallels. Both needed caretakers to look after them. Einstein was not very successful in his first marriage, and his second marriage to his cousin, Elsa, really was not a marriage of love, but he married someone who was able to take care of him. And after her death, he obtained this amazing woman, Helen Dukas, as his secretary, whom I never met but have heard all sorts of things about, and she must truly have been a remarkable person. Gödel, on the other hand, had a very stable marriage. The woman he married was very different than he was. She was Catholic. She was 6 years older than he was. She was a divorcee. She had a prominent port wine birthmark. And it was somewhat scandalous that she was a dancer. And she claimed to have been a ballet dancer, but the evidence seems to point more likely that she was a cabaret dancer. At any rate, she served him very well, took care of him. In particular, one of Gödel's mental problems, one of the forms of paranoia that he had, was a fear that someone was trying to poison him. And even before they were married, his wife Adela served as his taster and protected him from the outside world in that way. Some of his colleagues at the Institute for Advanced Study, the mathematician Oswald Veblen, Einstein himself, and later the economist Oscar Morgenstern, especially after Einstein's death, basically took Gödel under their wing and helped to sort of protect him from the outside world. Of course, both Einstein and Gödel were geniuses that tackled major problems, and as I mentioned a moment ago, both did make discoveries concerning the cosmological structure of space-time, and I'll say a little bit more about Gödel's results in that respect toward the end of the talk. As far as their health is concerned, there were some parallels and contrasts there as well. Each of them at one point was incapacitated by stomach ulcers and had to observe a strict diet. In fact, Gödel nearly died of a bleeding ulcer. And Einstein was one of those who, in a sense, did something to help him recover. Again, I'll say more about that in a moment. Both of them were nursed back to health by devoted wives. Each had a period during which they were incapacitated by the stress of overwork, Gödel more seriously than Einstein. But Einstein, fortunately, did not suffer the bouts of mental illness that Gödel did. Well, so much for the background on the two individuals. They both ended up at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which was founded in 1930 with a mission somewhat similar to that of the Perimeter Institute. It was a haven for scholars that were unfettered by teaching obligations or any precise research agenda. The Institute was funded by Louis Bamberger and his sister, who were the owners of Bamberger's department store in New York City, a major department store. And they had the good fortune to sell that store just a couple of weeks before Black Friday, when the stock market crashed. So they had a lot of money available during the Depression. And the question was, what should they do with that money? They wanted to found a medical research institute, and they sought for advice Abraham Flexner, who had written a famous and very scathing report about the state of American medical education back in the 20s. Flexner, however, felt that by that time there were other institutions that were significant medical research institutions, including the Rockefeller Institute in New York, where Abraham's brother Simon was the director. And he persuaded the Folds that a more meaningful way to use their money would be to establish such a research institute. At the time, the idea was very novel. There just were no other institutions of that sort. Eventually, he persuaded them, and he also persuaded them to situate the institute in Princeton. Like the Perimeter Institute, it began life in rented quarters or temporary quarters. The first few years, the scholars at the institute actually were housed in the math department at Princeton University nearby. And there was some friction because of fears that they might sort of raid the Princeton faculty. It began operations 3 years after it was founded in 1933, and both Einstein and Gödel were present that first year. Einstein was actually the first person given a faculty appointment at the Institute for Advanced Study. Initially, there was only one school, a school of mathematics. So although we think of Einstein as a physicist, the Institute regarded him as a mathematician, and of course his eminence was such that it was a great coup to get him to be on the faculty. Gödel, on the other hand, was a temporary visiting member. They didn't even have names for them at the time. He was referred to simply as a worker. The reason the Institute started out as a school of mathematics was because it was felt that that was the one discipline in which there was no disagreement about who the great figures were. There wasn't the factionalism that was to be found in many other disciplines. Later, it was expanded to schools of economics and politics, which still later was transformed into a school of historical studies. Then a natural science school was added. The name's a little misleading because until very recently it didn't include biology, for example, but was almost exclusively theoretical physics and astrophysics. And then most recently a school of social science. It moved into its own building called Fold Hall after the founder in 1939. It is located in Princeton, but it's very much on the edge of town in a quite inconspicuous location. It's a beautiful pastoral place, and this building reminds me indeed of one of the buildings there. It has served its purpose very well, and it's fortunate that it's located where it is, because if you go there, you will see many rather distracted individuals wandering across the roads. And if it were closer to downtown Princeton, I'm afraid there would be some serious injuries. It doesn't have any prominent signs, and unlike the Perimeter Institute, it does not have a public outreach program. In fact, it's so inconspicuous that occasionally visitors wander in and ask the secretaries there what sort of institution it is. One of the secretaries there became tired of answering that sort of question, and she eventually started telling such people that it was a daycare center for adults. Which is actually fairly close to the mark in some respects. There was one other institution, neither Gödel nor Einstein were associated with it, but it's interesting that it was founded the same year. That's Black Mountain College, which no longer exists. It was sort of an intellectual commune that was founded by some dissident faculty that had been fired from a university down in Florida. And like the Institute for Advanced Study, it was one of the two major institutions in the United States that offered sanctuary to many intellectual refugees of the Holocaust. Black Mountain College primarily offered a refuge to artists, musicians, and humanists, whereas the Institute for Advanced Study, of course, offered refuge mainly to scientists and especially mathematicians. So how did Einstein end up at the Institute for Advanced Study? Well, he rose through the ranks from associate to full professor, first at the Universität Zürich. Then he moved to Prague. It's not really quite clear why he went there, why he thought that that was desirable. He didn't stay there very long. Eventually returned to the institution from which he'd received his degree, the ETH. In 1913, he then accepted a call to become a research professor in Berlin. And during that period, from 1912 to 1919, he then formulated the general theory of relativity, in which he was able to explain gravitation as a warping of space. using mathematics that had been developed by various other people. As his fame grew, the fact that he was Jewish caused him to become a target for anti-Semites, and so it became less pleasant to be there in Berlin. In 1922, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, but not for relativity theory, because it was still felt that it hadn't been sufficiently experimentally established. So he was given the prize for the photoelectric effect instead. He became, of course, a world lecturer, a world traveler, and in 1930-31 visited the California Institute of Technology, which very actively recruited him to become a faculty member there. The Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton got wind of that effort, and when he stopped by in Princeton, they competed with Caltech and eventually won out. And so Gödel agreed to accept a split appointment. He would spend half the time in Princeton and half in Berlin. So in 1932, in December, he left Germany on a third visit to the United States, expecting to return to Germany, but because of the events, never did. The very next month, the Nazis assumed power in Germany. And although he did return briefly to Europe that spring, he did not return to Germany. He left Europe for the last time the following September and arrived in October of 1933, just with a visitor's visa in the United States. Gödel, on the other hand, in 1933, was teaching his first course at the University of Vienna. He paid his first visit to the Institute in 1933 and 1934, where he lectured on his incompleteness theorem. Unfortunately, on his own return to Europe in the spring of 1934, he developed a serious case of depression and had to enter an Austrian sanatorium for treatment. He did recover from that relatively quickly, and in 1935 taught another course at Vienna, and obtained the first of several results in set theory, a branch of mathematics that had been developed in the previous century and it was coming to be increasingly important. There were questions about whether certain axioms were consistent with other axioms, very similar in a sense to the question about the parallel postulate in Euclidean geometry. And so these were major results that he then began working on. He was invited to return to the Institute in 1935, but he was only there for about a month when he suffered a relapse of depression, and this time a more serious relapse. Let me talk just a little bit about the theory of sets to put it in context. It's a theory that is regarded today as the basis for all of mathematics. It was initiated in the previous century by the mathematician Georg Cantor, who found a way of comparing the sizes of infinite magnitudes. So you might think that all infinite quantities are simply infinite and that there's no way to distinguish among their sizes. But Cantor's idea was a very simple one. When you first learn to count, you do so by matching things with your fingers. Well, in general, his definition of when two collections have the same number of objects is simply, can you match the objects in a one-to-one fashion so that each object in one collection is matched with exactly one object in the other, and nothing's left over. In that way, for example, just by multiplication by two, you can match all of the positive whole numbers with just the even whole numbers, so that even though the even numbers are a proper part of all whole numbers, in this sense that I've just described, they're the same number of each. The question then becomes, well, do all collections of numbers turn out to be the same size? And Cantor also showed that that's not the case. He showed that if you consider all decimal numbers, that there are more of them than there are whole numbers. And the argument is very simple. Suppose you have any list indexed by the whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, and so on, of decimals, say just between decimals between 0 and 1, it's easy to construct a decimal that differs from the first one in the list in the first decimal place, differs from the second number in the list in the second decimal place, from the third in the third decimal place, and so on. And as a result, the list you have, no matter how you constructed it, cannot include all decimal numbers. So there's no way to match them up, and there must be many more of them. The theory that Cantor then originally developed was axiomatized in the 1920s by another German mathematician, Ernst Zermelo, and later one more axiom by way of completion was added by Abraham Frankel. And one of Zermelo's axioms became extremely controversial, much as the parallel postulate in geometry had been controversial. It's known as the axiom of choice, and it was a principle that had so escaped notice that mathematicians had used it in their proofs without even being aware of it. But when it was pointed out that they had been using this principle, suddenly it became controversial, in part because of some of its extremely paradoxical consequences, one of which is that if you take an ordinary sphere, it's possible to decompose it into as few as 5 parts, separate those parts by rigid motions, and reassemble parts to obtain 2 spheres equal in size to the original. The loaves and the fishes principle. Well, in 1937, Gödel taught his last course at Vienna, though at the time he didn't realize it would be such, and proved further consistency results in set theory, about which I'll say a little bit more. He also married Adela Porkert, but surprisingly left her in Vienna while he returned to the United States to lecture again at the Institute for Advanced Study on his consistency results. And he was also invited that time to go on in the spring to Notre Dame to lecture there as well. Let me just say a little bit about his consistency results. The axiom of choice is a simple statement. It merely says if you have an infinite collection of sets, and if each set has some object in it, then it's possible to form a set containing one element from each of set in that infinite collection. You simply pick one object out of each set. And there's also a famous statement known as the continuum hypothesis, which was originally a conjecture by Cantor, that there's no set, no infinite set, whose size is intermediate between that of the integers and the decimal numbers. So we've seen that there are more decimal numbers than there are integers. The question is there anything in between? Well, Gödel proved that both the axiom of choice and the continuum hypothesis are consistent with the other axioms that have been developed. So you can assume them without ever creating a contradiction. Well, Gödel returned once again to Europe, to Austria in particular, in the summer of 1939, undoubtedly to be reunited with his wife. To his great surprise, especially in view of his mental incapacitation and his time he'd spent in sanatoria, he was declared fit for Nazi military service, fit for garrison duty. And that then, of course, he urgently wanted to emigrate. At the same time, the Nazis had abolished the position of Privatdozent, and they had replaced it by a similar position, which actually was a paid position, but which required being vetted by the Nazi bureaucracy. And so they began examining Gödel's political opinions and so on. The Institute for Advanced Study gave a great deal of assistance to Gödel, pulling strings both in the United States and with their embassies in Germany. And with their help, surprisingly, despite the fact he was eligible for the draft, Gödel was able to obtain exit permits and transit visas that would allow he and his wife to escape from the Nazi territory. However, by that point, in part due to the submarine warfare in the Atlantic, and in part to an explicit requirement of the transit visas, he was only able to leave by taking the Trans-Siberian Railway. So he went all the way from the German border across Siberia in January, by the way. Not exactly the warmest time to cross Siberia. To Vladivostok. There he took a ship to Kobe, Japan, where he and Adela had to wait for a while for another ship to come from Shanghai to pick them up, take them first to Hawaii, and then finally to San Francisco. So it was a very long journey. They arrived in San Francisco on the 4th of March, and then, almost immediately, took a transcontinental train to Princeton, after which he very rarely left Princeton. So it was a remarkable journey, and surprising, given Gödel's health concerns, that he actually made it in quite good shape. Unfortunately, he didn't leave us an account of that journey. It would be very interesting had he left some sort of diary entry. Once he got to the Institute, it's rather surprising. He was reappointed annually as a member, but he was not given a long-term appointment. He worked primarily in philosophy for the first 6 years. Finally, in 1946, they did give him permanent membership, and 2 years later, he became a U.S. citizen, which was the occasion for a famous incident I'll mention later. In 1949 and 50, there was a celebration of Einstein's work on the occasion of Einstein's 70th birthday, and Gödel was asked to make a contribution, and that sparked his work in relativity theory, when he found solutions to Einstein's field equations of gravitation that were profoundly unexpected, both by him and by everyone else. It was the following year that he nearly died from a bleeding ulcer, and later, as he was recovering, shared the first so-called Einstein Award. Finally, in 1953, he was both elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and finally made a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study. So it's in 1953 that he has his first official appointment as a true faculty member. Really a remarkable fact given the character of his work. Well, I want to focus then on the friendship between the two. Although Gödel would have met Einstein presumably in 1933, they didn't really make much acquaintance until much later. They were introduced by Paul Oppenheim, an old friend who was actually a chemist. And in 1943, Gödel, Einstein, Russell, and Pauli met several times in Einstein's home to discuss philosophy of science. And there soon developed a firm friendship between the two of them. They became walking companions. They often walked to and from the Institute together. And one wonders, what did the two of them talk about? Well, it turns out we have Gödel's own statement about that. So I've given the German text of a letter that he wrote to Carl Zeilig, who was one of Einstein's biographers. And he told Zeilig, I came to know Einstein in 1933 on my first visit to Princeton, but only after I'd settled permanently in Princeton did I come into close contact with him. From then on, I very often enjoyed his companionship. Our discussions mainly had to do with philosophy, physics, and politics. Einstein regularly told me about the progress or modifications of the unified field theory. Moreover, we frequently spoke about matters on which Einstein's opinion was at hand in published form, and finally also on a series of questions that were stimulated by my own work and views. I have often reflected on why Einstein took pleasure in speaking with me, and I believe one of the reasons was that I often was of the contrary opinion and made no secret of it. I was never a collaborator of Einstein's, since I very skeptically opposed the unified field theory. My own works on relativity theory are concerned with the pure gravitational theory published in 1916, which I, as well as Einstein himself and the entire contemporary generation of physicists, believe was left standing as a torso, and indeed in every respect, physical, mathematical, and as regards its applications, cosmology. There are four examples of Einstein's personal interactions with Gödel that I want to briefly describe. First, Gödel's citizenship hearing. Second, the 70th birthday celebration for Einstein and the sharing of the first Einstein Award by Gödel. And then something about their political views and interactions. Einstein, it turns out, together with the economist Oscar Morgenstern, was one of the two witnesses at Gödel's citizenship hearing. And Morgenstern also served as chauffeur because Gödel did not drive. But there was a problem because Gödel was very meticulous and he studied for his citizenship examination as he did everything else very, very carefully. And he had talked to Morgenstern beforehand and Morgenstern had become worried and shared his fears with Einstein that Gödel might jeopardize his chances for citizenship if he started talking about something that was apparently occupying his mind, so Einstein did everything he could on the drive to try and distract Gödel, because Gödel was convinced he'd found a contradiction in the U.S. Constitution. Several people have asked me what the contradiction was, We don't know. If he did write it down, it's probably in some of his shorthand notes. Most of his works, his private works, are in this obsolete German shorthand, which is one of the things we had to contend with when we were editing his collected works. At any rate, in view of recent events in the United States, I don't know why anyone would doubt this. Now, turning to the 70th birthday celebration, as I mentioned, Gerdl had agreed to contribute an essay commemorating that birthday, which was to be a short article on the relation between relativity theory and Immanuel Kant's philosophy. And he did, in fact, in the end, deliver such a short essay. But in the course of that work, he discovered these unforeseen models of Einstein's equations of general relativity, in which not only is the notion of time relative, but there is no framework whatsoever that could be singled out as giving an absolute time framework. And in some of these so-called rotating universes, there are closed time-like lines, which means that without violating the principle that says that the speed of light is the maximum attainable velocity, you could revisit your own past. This has some very unusual consequences, needless to say, and it shows that there's a difference between temporality and causality. Again, both Einstein and Gödel are strong believers in causality. So what happens if you revisit your own past? Well, the principle of causality says there's certain things you can't do. For example, you can't kill your grandfather. And so it forced a reevaluation of, again, the nature of time and its relation to causality. Now, we know, in fact, that these universes are non-expanding, so they do not correspond with the observed redshift, and so our universe is not one of Gödel's universes. Nevertheless, the mere possibility that there could be such universes that are consistent with Einstein's equations shows that our notion of the passage of time is deeply problematic. And it also may cause you to ask, well, should something be added to Einstein's equations to rule out these types of universes? Surprisingly, they really garnered very little attention at the time, and it's only fairly recently that people have begun to look at these models of Gödel's more intently. Well, in 1950, Louis S. Strauss, a prominent figure in the United States, and who was a trustee of the Institute for Advanced Study, endowed the Einstein Award, a gold medallion and check for $15,000 that was to be given once every 3 years on Einstein's birthday. And 1951 was the first year that it was awarded, and the physicist Julian Schwinger had been selected to receive that award. And yet, when the award ceremony actually took place, he shared the award with Gödel. Well, what happened here? Well, we know from Oskar Morgenstern's diary that what happened behind the scenes was that Gödel had been hospitalized with this ulcer from which he nearly died. And once it became clear that he was recovering, Einstein and Morgenstern wanted to do something to buck up Gödel's spirits. And they realized that he'd never received any sort of public recognition up to that time. And so Einstein went back and talked to the others on the committee, and they changed their recommendation, and the award was actually shared between Schwinger and Gödel. So the award was presented by Einstein himself, and he quipped to Gödel at the time, to my good friend Gödel, and you don't need this, referring to the myth that the IAS faculty were so well paid. Actually, Gödel had, in fact, sustained some fairly sizable medical bills and did, in fact, need the money as well as the recognition. Well, I've also talked briefly about the fact that Einstein was an activist for peace, and he, of course, helped initiate the Manhattan Project, but at the same time, he never worked for the Manhattan Project because he was too outspoken about his political views and he was considered a security risk by the U.S. government. You're probably familiar with Einstein's famous letter to Roosevelt, in which he warned Roosevelt about the threat of enemies developing atomic weapons. Actually, this letter was not written by Einstein. It was written by Leo Szilard, who persuaded Einstein to send it to Roosevelt. And note the date, it's August 1939, and that, of course, set in motion the Manhattan Project. Well, it's interesting in that context that in May of 1972, Goethe received a letter from Professor Hans Thiering, who'd been one of his instructors at the University of Vienna. Thiering was an old man by that time. He realized he didn't have very long to live, and he urgently wanted to know whether one thing he did might have had an effect on world history. So he wrote to Goethe in German, and I've marked a passage here in red. He says, "I clearly recall your visit in the year 1940, as you parted from me on your adventurous flight from Hitler across Russia and China, and finally landed in the United States." And then the later passage, "At that time, I bade you get in contact with Einstein and urge him to make President Roosevelt aware of the great danger that would ensue if Hitler's Germany had the bomb ready before the United States." So what did Goethe say in reply? Well, he says, "I recall only that I conveyed your greetings to Einstein. I didn't know a chain reaction had been achieved, and when I heard of such things later on, I was very skeptical, not on physical, but rather on sociological grounds, for I thought that that development would only take place toward the end of our culture era, which presumably still lay in the distant future." It's a very curious statement, but it's consonant with other remarks of Goethe that he had a very Spenglerian view of history, that things only happened at their appropriate times, and time wasn't ripe yet for this. So in fact, the issue was moot because Einstein's letter had already been written several months before Goethe's emigration, so even had Goethe carried out Turing's instructions, it wouldn't have had an effect on history. But it's rather interesting to see that connection. Well, Goethe did not make many public utterances, but he did tend to agree with Einstein in many cases, and he sometimes quoted Einstein in his letters to his mother, who was living in occupied Vienna. And so in one of them, he quoted one of Einstein's criticisms of U.S. foreign policy. I included this to give you an example of Goethe's handwriting, which, if you read German, I think is actually remarkably clear handwriting. And Goethe is known for the clarity of his writings, not only his handwriting, but his papers are marvels of clarity. And in many cases, the best thing to do if you're studying Goethe is read his own works directly and not bother with the secondary commentary. At any rate, I'll translate a passage from this. "Einstein warned against seeking to achieve peace through rearmament and intimidation of the enemy. He said that that would necessarily lead to war and not to peace, and he was quite right. And it is well known that the other approach, seeking accord by amicable means, was not tried by America at all, but was rejected from the first. Who began it all is not the only question, and is also for the most part difficult to determine. But in any case, it is certain that under the slogan of democracy, America is carrying on a war for a completely unpopular regime," referring to the Truman regime, "and in the name of a police action for the UN is doing things with which the UN itself disagrees." Well, Austria was under occupation, and his mother happened to live in the area of Vienna that was under American occupation. And so his letter was intercepted by US Army censors, who passed it on to the FBI. And here's a copy of their appraisal of it. I obtained this through the Freedom of Information Act. So you can see they've translated the letter as well. And then below it, they have given what information they have about Goethe. They say, well, he's listed as a male German alien of military age who registered at the German consulate in New York City. In conformity with a law that required all German nationals to report. The files contain no additional information on him, so it's not believed that an investigation concerning him is justified at this time. But they had their eye on him, and there was one later letter he wrote to his mother that was also intercepted and sent to the FBI. Doesn't seem to have made much impression, and so he was not subject to any investigation. Of course, the FBI also had a substantial file on Einstein, so it didn't matter who you were scrutinized. But they didn't always agree, and particularly in the 1952 presidential elections when Einstein supported Stevenson. And afterwards, Einstein quipped to one of his friends, "Gödel's now completely crazy. He voted for Eisenhower." Well, the friendship, of course, ended with Einstein's death on 18th April 1955, when he died of a ruptured aortic aneurysm. He actually lived for a few days after the rupture, but the event was a profound shock to Gödel. Gödel wrote to his mother afterwards that he had not seen it coming at all, apparently, despite their friendship, and despite the fact the aneurysm had been discovered more than 6 years earlier, Einstein never mentioned it to him. And so Gödel was pretty distraught. Together with Einstein's last collaborator, a woman named Maria Kaufmann, Gödel helped organize Einstein's papers that had been left in his office. And he attended the IAS memorial service for Einstein. But unlike Einstein, who was a good violinist, Gödel didn't care much for classical music. And he said in a letter to his mother that that memorial service was the first time he'd ever allowed himself to endure 2 hours of Bach, Haydn, and the like. He preferred things like "O Mein Papa." Gödel published his last paper in 1958, but it was based on work he'd actually done in 1940 and 1941, his first year in the United States. It, too, was a seminal contribution and outlined a way to prove that arithmetic was consistent, something that one of his theorems had shown you cannot do within arithmetic itself, but you can do it if your principles slightly go beyond arithmetic, and it's possible to do it in a way that the principles themselves are very intuitive and acceptable. And in 1963, his set theoretic consistency results were extended in a way that he had expected and, in fact, tried to do himself, but had been unable to achieve, by an American mathematician, Paul Cohen. Gödel, recall, had shown that the axiom of choice and the continuum hypothesis could be added to the other axioms of set theory without leading to contradiction. Cohen showed that you could do the same thing with the negations of those statements, that they could be adjoined to the other axioms. So you have a choice. You can either believe in those principles or not believe in them, but either way, there's no contradiction. So you could adjoin either one depending on your preference. Gödel became increasingly withdrawn, and his mental problems recurred. In particular, the fear of being poisoned led him to eat less and less. And when his wife's health also began to deteriorate, she was unable to continue in her role as taster. He retired at the age of 70, the mandatory retirement age at the Institute, in 1976, and he died on the 14th of January, 1978, of malnutrition and inanition. He simply quit eating because he was afraid someone was trying to poison him. And so, in death, as in life, Einstein was honored and mourned throughout the world, but Gödel's death was largely unnoticed outside the mathematical community. There were obituaries in a few of the major world newspapers and in mathematical publications, but other than that, most people were unaware of his passing. I conclude then just by listing two outstanding biographies, and I'm going to be a little conceited to say that. Actually, there isn't much that competes that's actually been written about Gödel's life other than my own biography. There are a couple of popular works that don't go into a great deal of detail. And for Einstein, there are, of course, many excellent biographies. I will say that both of these do require some background in either mathematics or physics, so these two are not really for laymen. But if you're interested in digging deeper and you want to know a little bit about some of the technical details, they're very good places to start. So I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, John. We have time for a few questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and an usher will bring you a microphone. A question up there, please. Just wait 1 sec till your microphone arrives.
How did their education, their elementary education, compare Einstein's and Gödel's?
How did their reputations compare?
Sorry, their elementary education.
I'm sorry, elementary educations compare. Well, Gödel was actually an excellent student. He was educated in the German language schools in Brno, and his report cards survive. You can look at them if you go to the library in Princeton. It's interesting, the highest grade was sehr gut, very good. And in every reporting period, with a single exception, he received that mark in every subject. The one exception is that during his middle school years at one point, he received only gut in mathematics. And of course, Einstein, there are some sort of rumors I don't think are really quite true that Einstein had some trouble with his studies. Actually, the trouble he had when he went to the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule was simply that that's in Switzerland, where it's a multilingual country, and the standards are very high in languages. And in particular, he didn't do well in his French exam. By ordinary German standards, his French was probably pretty good, but by Swiss standards, it didn't pass the bar. So I think it's a myth that Einstein had weaknesses. Certainly, Einstein understood a lot of mathematics. It is interesting that Gödel started out at the University of Vienna intending to major in physics, and he was swayed from that path when he had a series of lectures from a man named Furtwängler, who was actually related to the orchestra conductor of the same name. And this is a well-known mathematician whose lectures were tremendously popular in spite of the fact that he'd suffered some sort of stroke and was paralyzed to the extent that he had to be carried into the lecture room, and he had to have an assistant write the equations on the board. But nonetheless, his lectures were so popular that they had to be repeated, and they issued alternate day seating passes and had about 400 students in these lectures, which for lectures on number theory is almost unheard of. So Einstein, there is a remark, I don't remember it exactly, but Einstein at one point said that he appreciated the beauty of mathematics and had been interested in it, but he never worked in that field because, unlike physics, he didn't have a feel for what the major problems were.
There's a question right here.
Other than his treatment for depression, did he have treatment for his mental health issues when he was in the United States?
He did have a psychiatrist in New York City and one in Princeton that he did visit. He was never institutionalized in the United States, and the institutions that he visited in, or that he actually stayed in Austria, have to be understood in the context of the times. They were certainly not what we would think of as a mental institution today. Sanatoria were places of peace and quiet, where there were psychiatrists on the staff, but it was not an asylum or anything like that. And the treatment, I think, was relatively mild. It was more a dietary regimen, exercise, and simply a way to get away from the world. He was diagnosed by a Nobel Prize-winning doctor, Julius Wagner-Jauregg, who won a Nobel Prize for an early treatment for syphilis. But he later became a psychiatrist, and I think he was sort of a colleague of Freud's. He certainly was well known in Austria at the time. What the diagnosis was is unclear. I'm not sure how many of those records actually survive, and of course, medical records are generally confidential anyway. But certainly had recurrent episodes, and his mental troubles were an undercurrent much of his life. They were just kept sort of submerged. But he was concerned not only about poisoning from food, but you see it even in his earlier years, he was afraid that some sort of gases were emanating from his refrigerator. And of course, Freon is poisonous, but we don't really know what the basis of these were.
We'll take one last question right here.
Yes, could you expand on causality? Meaning, do you think causality is doomed in use in physics?
Well, no, I don't necessarily think it's doomed. I mean, I think that in certain spheres, such as relativistic quantum mechanics, you know, there's still questions of how to interpret things in our world in a way that's consonant. I mean, there is still this divide, I think, in physics. I think the recent work in mathematics, in things like chaos theory, show that things that appear very random can be the result of things that are deterministic, but that are dependent very sensitively on initial conditions. And there's no way that we can possibly enumerate all these initial conditions. That's somewhat consonant with Gödel's point of view, that the appearance of chaos is in some sense an illusion, and that there are some deterministic principles at work. But a much more serious objection to causality, of course, is the duality in quantum mechanics, and that I don't think really has been resolved yet.
John Dawson will be participating in Bistro Banter this afternoon, hosted by Howard Burton, and also joined by Robert Schulman and David Rowe, 4 o'clock in the Black Hole Bistro, so you're welcome to join us for that. John Dawson, thank you very much for participating this evening.